This week on a very empathetic Eldritch Loras cast. I can't say Loras cast.
Legendary saving throws.
I think we could break it down to what do DMs use legendary resistance for?
That's such a spicy take, Sean.
Eldritch Loras.
Hasbro had an investor call.
What a sorry state that is for the MTG folks.
And the Eldritch Loras. Can't say Loras.
Humblewood has made it onto D&D Beyond.
This week on the Eldritch Loras cast.
Lego partnership rumor mill.
Do you know what helps is empathy.
You know what helps is empathy.
Have empathy. God damn it.
Rise and fall of evil genius games.
Down with empathy.
Yeah. Empathy's fine.
It's so unimpressive when people choose to suck.
All that and all the empathy right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. This is episode 125 of the number one tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms. If you are catching us live on Twitch, welcome. If you're watching on YouTube, welcome. If you're on Spotify, welcome. If you're on iTunes, welcome. If you're on any other sort of podcatcher, welcome to you as well, wherever you are, day or night, whatever it happens to be.
That felt so welcoming.
I thought you were going to do some sort of trademark sarcasm there, Ben.
What's trademark sarcasm?
I don't know. Just sort of something biting but fun, like into everyone else on every other podcasting platform. Get out of here.
No. I'm reminding myself that my New Year's resolution is not to faux or fake negativity anymore. Because I was doing it assuming it was a hilarious joke and don't think it was coming off quite as disarming as I had assumed it was.
What if you're not faking it?
Well, now you'll know. Now you'll know for sure. That is the voice of Sean Merwin, the voices of Sean Merwin, James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, who are also on this podcast. Dale, I'm going to ask you a question, and that question is legendary saving throws. A GM says no, or a clever design that players should learn to strategize around.
Are those the only options?
No, you definitely can get broader than that.
I think that legendary saving throws are a step in the right direction. They're not my favorite implementation of the concept, right? I think that it is not fun to be in a boss battle and have, you know, your, I don't know, hypnotic pattern land immediately, and so the bad guy just stands there while you kill them, right? I don't think that is actually fun for players. I think it's the old Colville adage, players given the opportunity will optimize the fun out of the game. so I think that giving your big bad guy an ability to kind of lessen that issue is a good idea. I keep it in my toolbox, but I often employ other things instead. I've brought up Bite the Bullet before, which is similar. It's like they can shed an effect on them, but they have to lose some hit points to do it, things right. Like that. I like playing around with those sorts of things where it feels a little bit less just like, I don't know, a force field that you have to fight your way through.
Yes, yeah, yes.
To me, legendary resistance seems like kind of a kludge to solve a mismatch between the way D&D is designed to be played and the way people want to play D&D, right? These legendary monsters are designed to be fought solo. And in 4th edition, for example, there was a whole class of monster called a solo monster designed to be fought individually. But one of the reversions 5e made is to kind of go back to a, I don't know, let's call it a less gamified take on D&D, a somewhat more naturalistic take on D&D. And so that means that these monsters, they're just the same as any other monster. They aren't designed to be especially powerful for a group of creatures to, for a group of adventurers to take on as just a solo boss. But people will want to do that. People will want to do that instead of fighting them in large groups the way D&D works best to balance out the action economy. So let's give them a few things to make them work within the action economy, not get locked down first thing. And I think it, yeah, just like Dale said, I think it mostly works. The biggest problem with it is that it doesn't feel particularly natural, right? For a convenience designed to keep the monsters feeling somewhat naturalistic, it's just like, it's a force field. You have to wear down its sort of out of game resource legendary resistance until you can do the thing that feels natural to do.
We've talked about many ways to use this, as Dale said, you know, giving up hit points. One other thing that I've tried in the past is to make legendary resistance a legendary action. So you have a certain number of points that you can do legendary actions with after one of the other creatures acts. So you could just say, all right, so I'm using up a point there. It can't take a legendary action next after you go, and it uses a point or two to kick in its legendary resistance. That helps the flow a little bit, but it all comes down to, as James and Dale have both been saying, in different words, story versus game, right? A game, you do things to win the game. A story does not necessarily flow well from things that make the game more interesting. So you try to design a way that the story works and the game works both for both the players and the dungeon master, and the story that's an artifact of play.
For me, it was like, I think they just need a bit of a reframing. And perhaps a little bit more specificity in how they're used in terms of what's said to the players in the moment. Because the tweet said something along the lines of, you know, similar to a GM using counterspell, GM says no to you using your cool ability. GM just hits the no button and that's not fun, in quotation marks. But I'm like, well, that's not really what they're attempting to do. They're not just there to make the GM seem like an asshole and to say no to players having fun. They're there as a strategic tool that players should be aware of and therefore strategize around. And there are problems with legendary resistances in terms of, like, the GM gets to roll first before deciding to use the legendary resistance or not. Do they tell the player that the legendary resistance has been used or not? Or do they just say they succeeded the save? The ability, I don't think, says whether or not the GM should tell the players. And so some GMs may prefer to keep that behind the screen, which I think is what creates a confusion and a sense of like, yeah, that ability didn't work. But if it's a little bit more upfronted and seen, as James said, as kind of like a resistance to magic or some sort or a quote unquote legendary resistance, then the players can strategize, all right, I'm going to cast banishment on it. I know it's probably going to use its legendary resistance to get around this banishment because why wouldn't it? But the point is to burn a legendary resistance because banishment is too costly to
it. Right, you spam your lower level spells, right?
Well, it's not even about lower level spells because you've got to try and fish out the legendary resistance.
That's
like
true.
The GM doesn't have to use the legendary resistance if the ability that they're going to suffer, if the damage they're going to suffer isn't that bad to the monster. You know, the monster gets poisoned while it's got resistance to poison or whatever, I'm not going to use the legendary resistance. I think the one change I would make to it, just very lightly, is that the GM chooses to use legendary resistance before rolling rather than after. So it's more of a game choice for the GM.
Because as soon as you said, the GM doesn't technically have to tell you if they use the legendary resistance, I like that more.
Oh, really?
I like that way more because it feels in line with like the GM doesn't have to tell you how many hit points a creature has left. You know what I mean?
Sure.
For me, that puts you more in a story headspace. I probably wouldn't do it. I probably wouldn't run it at the table. But if I was playing at a table where that happened, I'd be down. I'd be hip with that. Because at that point, it's like, oh, no, we don't know what's working, where we're at. It feels a little bit more like scrambly, desperate. I kind of like that.
Sure. I guess it's just for me ensuring that the players know that something happened and that the GM didn't just decide no. In a fight that I was doing recently, it was a bunch of higher level skeletons. I think I was using, they're called like the Carnathy soldiers or something from some supplement.
But
I always use them for like higher level skeletons because I think they work really well for like skeleton soldiers. And they have a parry. So their AC is like 17, but it can go up to 20 with a parry, I think, off the top of my head. And so sometimes my players would hit and they'd get a 17 and 18. I'd be like, yeah, that hits. And sometimes they'd roll a 19 and it wouldn't hit. And to avoid them just getting confused and disgruntled and annoyed and be like, well, they hit, why didn't I? You know, making sure I communicate, you see them react and intercede with their shield or their weapon or whatever, so that players know something is happening, whether it's described in story or described above the table, so that they can strategize around that and engage with the game systems as opposed to just being frustrated and feeling like the GM said no. Anyway, I have opinions on legendary resistances. That's all.
Do you know what helps is empathy as a player and as a DM? Understanding how the other person would feel. And the second thing is, I think we could break it down to what do DMs use legendary resistance for? When would they use it and when wouldn't they use it? And if you can pinpoint the times that they would use it, what we can do instead is just make the monsters immune to that and walk away. We don't need legendary resistance. You want to cast Fireball and upcast it and Flame Strike and all of those things? Great. Do that. You don't have to worry about the legendary resistance there. And we'll get rid of the things that make the combat less fun.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the issue with that is there's just so many spells in the game. There's definitely been situations.
That's such a spicy take, Sean. It sounds so reasonable on its surface. But the more I think about it, the more I'm like, I don't know about this. It's like, okay.
Down with empathy.
Empathy's fine. And empathy, that's good. I'm here for empathy. But like, I remember playing Final Fantasy and never, ever, ever taking spells that would like stun or paralyze, because against the regular guys, it was way more worth it to just burn them down with damage than play strategically. And all the bosses were immune to stun and paralyze and things like that. And those are the guys I would really want to use those big effects for, because it would cause them problems. Those are the hard ones. And so it basically just meant there was a whole class of spells that never, ever, ever got used by me. I wish there were a way to like use those cool effects, the ways that it's like, okay, I'm turning the DM's toys against them. That's what it feels like to me anyway. But maybe like, I don't know, have it paralyze a limb of the dragon rather than the whole thing, and remove an attack from its attack suite or something like that, rather than, all right, you suck. This monster can't do anything.
You know what helps is empathy.
And repetition.
empathy. No, I'm just thinking about, I feel like, because I was reading, it was an old post on Reddit, so it was like 2 years old now, so not exactly, piping fresh, but it was another take that is along the lines of, the DM ruins the fun for the players by not letting them do things. But I think that the empathy works in both directions, right? Like, it's, mm-hmm. There's a whole genre of video games that is 1v5 player setups, right? It's you've got this one player who is given so much power versus the five other players or however many other players. And you don't feel like in that situation, oh, it's unfair that they're using this, strong ability or they've got immunity against, but you don't feel in that situation as one of the five, oh, it's not fair that they're doing this. This is treating me badly to use these abilities against me. Because you understand that that's the contract. And I think that we've got kind of this weird thing where we're living in a world where you've got so many people who think, oh, the DM should be there to serve the players. It's a very subservient role. They're really leaning into doing everything to make the players' dreams come true. And then you've also got this kind of image of, the maniacal DM who's doing everything in their power to ruin things for the player party.
Right.
And to really stomp on their fun and destroy their hearts. And I feel like if we look at it with empathy, we recognize everyone here is a player. The one player who's been given a lot of power and also a lot of responsibility, they have to be having fun as well, but they also have to be looking out for the fun of the five player. You know what I mean? It's all empathy. As a DM, you should be looking for places where people can use those cool abilities and feel awesome. But as a player, I don't think it's fair to also expect the DM to have their monster that they've made, it just be stunned and not get to do anything. It's all empathy. Empathy.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm always, I feel like I'm like a GM activist, where I'm always like, remember, GMs are players too. They're not serving the players like unless you're hired to be a GM, and that slightly changes. But, Web DM did a video. This was also not piping hot. This would have been like 5 years ago or something like that, where they talked about the tyranny of fun. And like, this mechanic wasn't fun, so we removed it out of our game and we got rid of this because it wasn't, fun. And And as Dale, you said, as Colville quoted, you know, the players will often optimize the fun out of the game. And so often chasing fun, like what's the most fun, can remove, in my opinion, challenge, or can remove, you know, hardship.
Not every story is fun, right? Sometimes you want an RPG story where fun is not the goal. Fun maybe should be what you feel afterwards. And you're like, oh my God, that was so viscerally satisfying. I had a lot of fun.
Success and fun are not the same thing. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, that was the opening question for this week's Lorecast. Sorry. If you want to write an email in, like I did, to the Eldritch Lorecast, email podcast@ghostfiregaming.com, and we'll get around to them.
Ben, you had to jump through the hoop of emailing yourself to justify that one.
These are dark times. It's so sad.
All right. Let us move on to the news, because there was a little bit of it this week. Da, 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 da. News, news, news. Starting with Hasbro had an investor call or an earnings call last week, I think just after the Lorecast recorded. And, you know, I'm not too concerned with the minutiae, but there are a few tidbits that you can pull out of it as a fan about what might be coming down the pike and which direction, or the pipe, whatever you prefer. That as a fan you can pull out about what might be coming along. Starting with Hasbro apparently considering a Universes Beyond, in quotation marks, style content for D&D Beyond. For those that don't know what that means, basically Magic the Gathering has been through Secret Lairs and Universes Beyond inviting other IPs to do sets of Magic. Or licensing other IPs is probably more accurate, to do sets of Magic. Very famously last year was the Lord of the Rings set, which did incredibly well for them. They had a Warhammer 40K set. They did a Walking Dead set, and possibly a couple of others that I can't think of off the top of my head. Is it Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro? It was a little bit of an off-the-wall comment. He was kind of speaking a little bit casually, not overly specifically, to my interpretation of the quote, but kind of said that D&D Beyond could be utilized for a Universes Beyond style of content, possibly licensing other IPs that Wizards doesn't necessarily own. But also in that same quote, and this is where I kind of thought he might be moving, referencing the community creators and, quote, in quotation marks, our major creators, creating content, which I thought may hint at more third-party publishers, is what they mean, as much as going out and grabbing the Lord of the Rings license or the Star Wars license or whatever, especially because a lot of those licenses already have role-playing games. So it's kind of like what's left in the market for Wizards to kind of go after.
These investor calls, you have to take them with a heaping pile of salt, because they are there to calm the investors, especially when things aren't looking great. And if you're paying attention, things aren't looking great for Hasbro specifically, and for Wizards of the Coast tangentially. Any highlight that he could throw out, he's going to. He's like, hey, this worked great for Magic. We could probably do that over here, except we probably can't, because it's a completely different game with completely different monetization goals and completely different revenue streams. And like you said, Ben, they already have Doctor Who, Lord of the Rings, Warhammer, I could go on, and every one of them already has a role-playing game. But I think it's more just along the lines of, we need to use D&D Beyond to its fullest potential if we're going to profit. And so we all calls are being taken, I think where we stand, including Legos and Pop-Tarts and Converse. So,
yay. Woo!
Woo!
Yeah, as the resident MTG person, which, what a sorry state that is for the MTG folks. But I am evidently in the minority when it comes to hating the Worlds Beyond thing. I don't want the Walking Dead Magic sets, you know what I mean? But for Walking Dead fans, that's cool. You get a bunch of cards that you can play. They've got cool pictures on them. Oh, what a lovely, you know, it's those are products that are made not for, you know, Magic the Gathering fans. They're made for bringing fans of other things into Magic the Gathering.
Sure,
and whether that would work for D&D, I don't know. Especially when I keep in mind that Hasbro does have several RPG systems in place for properties that are not D&D that use the Essence 20 system, which is kind of an offshoot sort of 5e. You know, they've got them for Power Rangers, Transformers, G.I. Joe. So I, even once we start moving beyond the fact that there are all these properties that already have many of them popular and successful tabletop RPGs based around that thing that many fans love, we're already in a weird kind of zone where it's like, but you're kind of already doing that. That's already a thing that you're doing.
I thought it was completely odd that they wouldn't bring these Essence 20 games to D&D Beyond in some way. Even if it's just, look, here's a link to these other games. And maybe they did and I missed it, but it was like they tried to wall it off to the point where they didn't even want to mention it, which sure. seems strange if they want to digitally use D&D Beyond as a way to bring people into the hobby, in D&D especially. Why not at least start to leverage that tool for your other properties? But that's why I'm sitting here and you know, people making the big bucks are in Rhode Island.
Well, I don't know apparently. How different those other systems are, but the thing about D&D Beyond is that it seems specially engineered for 5th edition D&D. Could you, you know, D&D Beyond is not Demiplane, which has kind of gated areas where, like, you're in the Vampire Masquerade section and this is all going to be Vampire Masquerade in here. And this is the Pathfinder section, which is a software and engineering problem, right? Because I imagine the back end of those different game systems, it requires different software development tools, or maybe the same, you know, I don't quite have the language for this, maybe the same tools, but the back end would look different because they're different systems, right? The character sheets all look different. And so how equipped is D&D Beyond to actually introduce a new system onto that platform that's not explicitly 5e in some way?
I'm not talking about making character sheets and running the game through it. I mean on their blog to right. say, hey, here's a game. What do you let's do a poll. In a year, would you love to see Essence 20 games on D&D Beyond or aren't you interested? Just as a marketing tool. And I didn't see anything like that at all.
We've also got folks in chat who are bringing up, well, I'm synthesizing what's being said, that cross-pollination between fandoms is not in and of itself a bad idea. Because mm-hmm. we have seen fairly successful cross-pollination of Magic the Gathering settings into D&D. And mm-hmm. we've seen fairly successful cross-pollination of D&D stuff into Magic the Gathering. And that is actually a very strong system because you've got two big fandoms that are both under Wizards of the Coast, but don't necessarily have a huge overlap. Like there are, of course, a lot of people who play both, but there's a lot of people who only play MTG and there's a lot of people who only play D&D out of those two things. And both of these settings or games from Wizards of the Coast have these incredible, like, self-made settings, these places that they've invented themselves and all this art to go with it, that you can just go whoop and suddenly you can get a ton of people to cross over to the other side and become a fan of both things. So it's not a terrible idea to, you know, do things like that. Mm-hmm. I think it, for me, crosses over into a zone of being a thing I don't care about when it's not a match. When there's no care given to what the property you're trying to translate is. I think that's a big factor. I want to feel like the people who are making it actually give a crap about the product they're making.
They did note in that same investor call that despite hefty licensing fees, which would have eaten into the profits of the Universes Beyond strategy for Magic the Gathering, that strategy was still considered a success, but noting that, if you're working with partners, you've got to pay for those licenses. So that's a thing that they said. I don't really have a comment on that. And then the one other little tidbit that was relevant from last week that they mentioned is that the D&D live action TV show that is not Dragonlance, because that got cancelled, is still in active development at Paramount for an 8-episode season as planned. Pilot written by the dude who wrote Red Notice. That's still going ahead. That's still alive. That project is still happening.
If it's good, I'll be happy. If it's bad, I will be sad.
Same.
I feel like that is a universal experience. Speaking of successful things, Humblewood has made it onto D&D Beyond, another third-party publisher. Humblewood is a Red Wall-inspired campaign setting from Hit Point Press, and it's available on D&D Beyond right now if you want to go get access to that. And it's exciting to see more third-party content on D&D Beyond alongside Lairs of Aetheris and Drakenheim from Ghostfire. So go Hit Point Press.
Great, great direction to go in for the next one. Love some Red Wallian respect.
Redwall was my favorite fantasy series as a kid, more than Harry Potter, more than, you know, more than The Hobbit, more than whatever else there was out there. Redwall was just awesome. Something about the puzzles, I think, the riddles really captured my imagination.
This is going to sound really odd, but go with me on this. I read a little bit of Redwall. I never really got into it, but I did. Redwall was kind of like a sneaker, you know, hit, I suppose, where people who loved it, but I never heard like a lot of people talking about it. But I don't know much about Humblewood. I do really like the aesthetic from the art that I've seen and the fact that it's kind of Redwall inspired and kind of, you know, anthropomorphic creatures inspired. Because as much as I'm not a fan of like tabaxi or arakocra or lion people or dog people kind of walking around in my generic fantasy, I love me a good like purpose-made, whimsical kind of
forest there's something. Critters.
Yeah, there's something very mythical about it that I really appreciate. You know, it feels like a mythology as opposed to trying to emulate some sort of history or something. Yeah, good on Hit Point Press. It's awesome to see more third-party publishers making it to D&D Beyond. And then speaking of partnerships, this was not from the investor call. This was kind of a little bit of separate news. Lego partnership rumor mill. Grinding up the rumor mill. Let's start the engine.
Rumor mill.
That's the new. That's my new section intros.
Dante, whip us up a graphic. Can you get a graphic? Just
rumor mill. Rumor mill.
Yeah, just whip one up, Dante.
Yeah, just as easy, right? Yeah, you can just do that.
Just remember that rumor has no U. It's just R-U-M-O-R.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Declaring war.
Inaccurate. So anyway, what are the rumors? They are that, so this came from, I believe, BrickTap, which is like a Lego rumor page. I found these published to Reddit, kind of backsourcing through some articles from some RPG news websites. So take this with a grain of salt. These are rumors. These aren't confirmed. The D&D Lego ideas set with the dragon that's attacking the tower is purportedly going to be out in April. Available for purchase in April. It's going to cost, they didn't explicitly say US dollars, but I'm assuming this is in US dollars, $360 or $359.99, which means it's going to be something like $700 Australian, $650 Australian, which is a little eye-watering, but
Lego be expensive.
Lego be expensive. The real plastic crack. And it's going to have 3,745 pieces.
Australian. I just, your number sounded too high, so I wanted to check. 550-ish Australian.
That's fair. No, that's fair. I usually like double it and then take a little bit off, but usually that does end up with an overstretch. And then the other kind of additional leak that has come out, which I don't believe has been officially announced as of yesterday, is that Lego are apparently releasing a series of D&D-themed collectible minifigures, of which they've had success of in the past. These figures are going to include kind of party members, including a Dwarven Barbarian, a Githyanki Warlock, a Tiefling Sorcerer, a Dragonborn Paladin, among others, as well as kind of known characters from the lore of D&D, including a Mind Flayer, Strahd von Zarovich, Lady of Pain, Zaz Tam, and Tasha the Witch Queen, which is a pretty good collection of Lego minifigures.
I'm surprised to see Githyanki getting like core rep in a Lego collectible minifigure
BG3.
Set. BG3, yeah,
it's had its impact.
Well, we see Gith in the Player's Handbook 2024. That's the new rumor.
Ooh, that's a good question.
Is that a rumor you just created?
Whatever happened...
I just made that rumor up, yeah.
Okay.
It starts here.
It's still here.
Rumor mill.
That one has two U's, though.
I'm mongering this rumor right now. Consider it mongered.
Now, I don't really understand the lore behind Githyanki that well. Why are Gith Zarai not getting the same treatment as Githyanki? Why is it always
because Githyanki were in Baldur's Gate 3.
Okay, all right, fair enough. So, yeah, I don't know. That'll make Justice Arm unhappy, I think.
I think it's going to be very cool. I'm very into it. I'm excited to see whether we get a D&D-sponsored episode on LEGO Masters, maybe, this year. That would be exciting and good. But it is interesting that, you know, LEGO has all these branded things. And with a lot of them, you get your sort of collector's items, your, like, you know, detailed AT-AT. I say AT-AT, not AT-AT, okay?
Dale is correct.
Right. Thank you so much. Thank you, James. You know, for Star Wars, you get your detailed sort of collector pieces that are expensive and fancy and ooh-ah, but you also get your kind of your accessible sets. My tiny little X-Wing that I have over here. You know, you've got the ones that are cheap that you can genuinely just play with for your Star Wars. Or you've got your Hogwarts collector piece that costs hundreds of dollars versus your little Harry Potter sets. And at the moment, it does look like we're just doing collector's pieces for D&D, especially the idea of, like, here are, you know, minifigs that you can buy individually. That's such a collector thing. I would love to see it trickle down into more, like, I know that at that point it's like, okay, but we already have fantasy sets or, like, knight sets.
Well,
but I would love to see more of it trickle down into the accessible, less sort of expensive stuff.
I didn't look more into this because it kind of fell off the relevance to this podcast, at least in some capacity. So I didn't drill down more into, but I believe LEGO either have recently or are about to or are in the process of kind of releasing a lot of their classical knight sets from like the 80s and 90s. So like, you know, I don't know if you remember like the red backgrounds and the green dragon with the red wings and I think there was a black dragon and knights and big castles. We had one of those sets when I was a kid. Those are amazing. And they could kind of cross over with D&D really, really easily if somebody wanted to run their D&D with minifigures instead of miniatures, which I think would be a lot of fun. But LEGO just this morning, Australia time, the LEGO Instagram account posted out on Instagram just a fairly innocuous thing, but it was like a gelatinous cube with LEGO skeleton and LEGO swords and shields kind of floating around inside of it. And they were like, we're getting excited. So I don't know whether they're about to make an announcement. I don't know whether the gelatinous cube is going to be a LEGO thing or whether that's, they just, you know, kind of photoshopped that together.
I hope they pull some classic LEGO shenanigans and it's actually like a big cube with gaps in the middle and you can put what you want in the hollow part. I would love that.
I thought too. Yeah, that'd be super cool. Morris of EN World posted an article last week kind of charting, as the article has entitled itself, The Rise and Fall of Evil Genius Games. If you don't know Evil Genius Games, they are not Evil Hat Studios. Just make sure that there's no confusion there.
Mm-hmm.
Evil Genius Games have released a couple of tabletop RPGs. They've only been around for a little while. They were founded, I believe, at the end of 2022. They've got a lot of IP games, including Rambo. They've done a couple of successful Kickstarters. What folks who listen to the Lorecast might remember them from is the lawsuit with Netflix around the Rebel Moon IP. They had been contracted or licensed to do a Rebel Moon tabletop role-playing game based on the Zack Snyder movie that released on Netflix last year. That contract got cancelled. There was a lawsuit that got settled, I believe settlement ended in January of this year. But Morris was able to speak to a number of past employees and a couple of current employees as well, because there has been a mass exodus from Evil Genius Games due to, very broadly speaking, ethical concerns around company culture, the behavior of the leadership team, unpaid wages, and the use of Web3 technologies and investment, Web3 being technologies such as AI, Bitcoin, blockchain, NFTs, that sort of thing. So it's a whole lot of mess. If you want to get the full context, you can go over to the article, which I am currently attempting to paste into the Twitch chat. But did you folks get a chance to read it? Did you have opinions on it?
It was the first thing I read while still in bed on the morning that it broke. It was a great read.
It sounds like the start of like a Madeline book. And I would be thrilled to read it. Sorry, please go on.
No, it's a great look at just the timeline of events. And, you know, Morris does a very good journalistically even-handed approach to the situation, even though I would say it's pretty clear who's in the wrong here. You know, just to add my two cents, I've never worked with them. I've never done anything in their orbit, but more than one colleague of mine has basically said, yeah, working with them is one of the worst experiences I've ever had working in RPGs. So I'm inclined to believe the bad stories about Evil Genius.
One thing to remember is that despite the tech bro hate that is well deserved, there are game designers whose livelihoods were tied up with them, and maybe still is. And so, you know, the Schadenfreude is can be fun, and we can say, "Ha, look at what happened." And there are 20 sides to every story, and even if 20 of the truths were told, there are several other ones that weren't. And you know, just having a full-time job in the tabletop RPG field is a unicorn. And it's very hard to do. It's very hard to hang on to. And I feel for the folks who either lost their job or felt the need to quit their job or are still there trying to salvage whatever is left of the projects that were being worked on. So yeah, it's tough. I hate to see it. But when I see companies where the technology is supposed to be selling the game and the investors are coming in to try to leverage NFTs and blockchain and Bitcoin to somehow improve the game, very rarely is the game improved by it. And it's probably the opposite.
Well, I think part of the issues, as Morris kind of described in the article, was also just a real confusion of message. Because a lot of Web3 investment firms had investment directly in the company. Employees expressed concern around the use of NFTs in game, as well as, you know, like, you get this sword and this is the sword that killed that dragon and you can, you know, you own that sword now as an imaginary NFT. In your mind, it's real. But then leadership kind of saying, no, don't worry, we're not. You know, we might use AI art. Oh, the employees don't like that. All right, maybe we won't. And the door never being fully closed on a lot of these conversations that it felt like for some employees that felt like they needed to resign their position. It just kind of kept coming up again and again. And so, you know, clearness of communication and policies, I think, would have helped a lot there as well.
There's the article and then there's Morris's podcast. And the podcast goes a little bit more into detail, showing all sides of the issues surrounding Evil Genius rather than just what the article said, which is a lot of anonymous stuff and doesn't necessarily capture everything that is going on there.
I just wanted to express, you know, admiration for people who are in a tough position, who, you know, decide to leave at great expense to themselves because they think that it's, you know, something that sits morally with them. I think that's very impressive. I also think it's, I mean, just broadly cross-industry, across all industries, really, it's so unimpressive when people choose to suck. It's like... Like it actually, I, you know, I'm 30 years old. I've met quite a few people in my life by now. And the vast majority of people I've met just, you know, meet the bare minimum of not sucking all the time. And yeah. I feel like that's a fairly reasonable bar to hold yourself to if you were in a position of, I don't know, power over, if you're in a position where you are hiring other people, you are establishing a company culture, just don't suck. Just don't suck. I don't need you to be like golden and perfect all the time, but just don't suck. Put in the work to be better than sucking. That's it. That's all my thoughts.
And that's the thesis of today's episode. Don't suck.
Have empathy. God damn it.
This is JP's question, coming in about no good choices, kind of in the narrative structure of your RPG campaign. What do you think of facing players with a decision in which all options are obviously bad in some way? Is this something that you do intentionally, or something that you try to avoid? I believe in their email, the example they gave was the party was kind of given the choice of choosing a new ruler of a kingdom, but each of them kind of had some sort of flaw that made them a less than ideal choice for rulership. How do you structure your campaigns in terms of, I suppose, in some capacity, like victory conditions?
I know I just said meet the bare minimum of don't suck. But I, as a player, certainly, I don't know if I've ever managed to pull this off as a DM, but as a player, I do kind of like it when there's no truly good option.
I think this is a great storytelling question we have right here, right? Because we here are all adults, which means we have moved past the sort of edgelord phase of everyone is evil. And we've also grown past the sort of, you know, fluffy, baby-proofed padded corners edge where, you know, the heroes can do no wrong. So we have all of this latitude in which to play. And it comes down to a question of genre. And as I will make my evergreen answer to many of the questions we get here on the Lorecast, bring it up in your session zero. What genre do you want your game to be? What's the overall tone of the story you want to tell in this game? I think D&D does a great job of telling stories where you have to make kind of hard moral choices, often because D&D's preferred mode of conflict resolution is bloody violence. Right? If you have to go toe to toe with someone who you don't really want to kill, but who you have very little choice but to kill, then that's a great D&D conflict right there. Similarly, for who will you fight for? Whose ideals will you champion? Stuff like that. And trying to make the best out of a kind of difficult world, I think, is very much in tone with the pulpy Conan-esque origins of D&D.
Yeah, that genre point is very, very well stated, because creating dilemmas in storytelling is tough. Creating good dilemmas. A lot of times the dilemmas we see are false dilemmas. They're dilemmas where if you step back and you just look at the question for a few seconds, you realize, but there's this third option. And if art does that, we tend to suspend our disbelief and say, oh, they didn't even consider the fact that, oh, there's these two mayors and we have to vote for one or the other. Well, we could just back this third person who would be great. And so when we give players agency, how much agency do we give them? If we only give them these two bad choices without really sitting down and thinking of the full range of solutions they may come up with, then we are doing a disservice to the story by giving them this false dilemma. Now, in certain genres, that it becomes a little more palatable because the players and the characters understand in some way that they're in this genre. Right? The villain runs this way, and the henchman with the prisoner or the kidnapped victim runs that way. And in the story, you have to go after one or the other. In the game, the party's going to split up because they have to. They want to do everything, right? And if you try to put a gate up so they can't, then that's when you get rightful grumbling that you are railroading and that you are doing things to take away their agency. So if it's done well, or if it's done within a medium that will allow it, it can work very well. But like, not every drama is going to be Sophie's Choice. Right. A lot of times we don't even want to think about setting up a situation where that is so cut and dry a choice to be made.
I'm going to need a Star Trek nerd to fill in and correct pieces of what I'm about to say. because I only know of this.
All right, Talman, you ready?
The Kobayashi Maru.
The Kobayashi, oh,
Kobayashi Maru.
See, what I know they
said,
a thing.
What they said.
The no-win scenario.
Oh, they said, which way are right? they? I don't know. No, I think they're that
there's
way.
There's no correct, like, there's no way to win. There's no way to get the right answer where you get the good ending unless you change the conditions of the test, right? Is that right? Great. Because mm-hmm. I do love it when that happens. I love giving, I love the idea, I say giving, but again, I don't know that I've actually done this in-game, but I've played Dragon Age. I love being given a situation where there are two obvious options, both of them bad, choose between, you know, which one do you think is the lesser of two evils? But mm-hmm. I love it when there's a secret third option that you can figure it out. If you put in enough effort, if you looked through enough things, if you dug up enough dirt on people, you can change the conditions of the test and get the secret good ending. I love that as an option too. There's everyone in chat is yelling, "Gone!"
Gone!
I feel like I've awoken something. but, you know, I genuinely feel like I had more interesting and valuable thoughts on this last night. But they're gone now. And there's only me. I don't know. I just like it. You know, we've got this example in the question of quite a political, you know, example. Who are we going to, you know,
yeah, I wonder where they're getting that from, where that's coming from.
Bit of power. What do you mean? Why does it have to come from somewhere?
Never mind. Go on.
There are lots of things.
That
was
a glib
joke.
That was a glib joke. Go on.
Oh, from real life.
Yes.
The worst fandom of all.
Yeah.
but, you know, you can apply it to other things. The other example that comes to mind is everyone's just shouting, Ben now. Ben! There's the example from Calamity on Critical Role when Brennan asked Marisha, okay, where's your character weakest, at the elbow or the shoulder? Neither of those options is good. But what a delightful moment. I just think it's neat to occasionally just put your players in a situation and say, this is bad, but you still have some agency in the situation, and that means something.
But I love creating no good outcome situations, because I think they feel real. They feel more real. They feel more grounded than necessarily like an obvious paladin of virtue versus a clearly evil, you know, that the party are fighting against. But there is a deftness to accomplishing that in game that doesn't make the players throw their hands up in the air and be like, well, what are we supposed to do? You know, because this all feels bad. You know, it can be very easy to demotivate your players if you, you know, present them three terrible options. And it can also be easy to make one option way more terrible than the other by accident. And so the players kind of go in one direction by default. But I love kind of setting up a conflict and then adjusting the nozzles on both players, where I'm like, okay, so this guy's not good because he kidnapped a bunch of you know, villagers, and this guy's bad because those are his villagers that got kidnapped, but he once sacrificed, I don't know, a baby. And I'm like, oh, wait, no, that seems way too evil. So this guy didn't just kidnap him. He killed the villager. No, this is getting too dark. All right, let's rewind. He didn't sacrifice the baby. He adopted the baby, you know, and you kind of go back and
that
forth
bastard.
On a moral scale. yeah.
Adopting yeah, babies.
Well, you know, like a changeling sort of situation, like a ward, a hostage, yeah. You know what I mean? And so going back and forth on the dials to kind of, you know, create a situation where the party feel conflicted, but they don't feel like there's a no-win situation where both of them absolutely suck. The other thing in terms of what you were saying, Sean, just quickly on having that third option is, as a GM, you don't have to have everything figured out. You don't mm-hmm. have to know what that third option is. You just have to be open to your players splitting the party and going after both, villain and henchman at the same time and having them deal with the consequences. Because to be honest, in my experience, most of the time, the party, the more they struggle to get the perfect outcome, the less perfect the outcome is often going to be as a result. I am going to jump to Sean because he looked like he was going to say something, Dale, but then...
That's why I'm doing this, so that I remember it after Sean.
Gotcha. I'm going to give a big pat on the back to my friend Teos. In organized play adventures, we would be able to have the game masters fill out a form at the end of the adventure to say what the party did. And sometimes we would put in choices. The choices, they could do 1, 2, or 3. And undoubtedly, almost every time, it would be choice 1 would be 92%, choice 2 would be 3%, and choice 3 would be 5%. And there's only one time when I saw the choices come in and they were all in the 33% range, somewhere in the 30% range. And Teos wrote an adventure where the characters needed to make a grand choice at the end of this adventure, a world-shaping choice. And the choices he made were 33, 33, 33 when we got the reports in. That's taking the time to make the choice really, really resonate and really be balanced. So you can do it. But as Ben said, too, you really have to think it through and adjust sometimes on the fly and sometimes through playtesting if you're publishing this adventure and sometimes just through workshopping to get the right words, because even the wrong word can set off a choice to become the obvious choice.
Yeah. So sometimes I just, sorry, very quickly, Dale, say to players, oh, I just said this is this NPC. Out of game, I just want to make it clear that they meant and said this and your players would have taken it that way, not what I just said, because I don't want you to misinterpret this NPC if I'm not intending it to be kind of like a red herring, if you will. Dale, go ahead.
This is just, it's just the only like helpful adjacent thing that has popped into my head the whole time is also play with the dials of like, what do the players get out of it? Like positives that you get out of these difficult choices, because often that can be a really effective thing as well. It's like, how much of your morality are you willing to sell out for something that's really helpful for you right now in this situation? That's a fun dial to play with in that kind of moral dilemma situation as well.
My players often walk around with none of the treasure that I've tried, because I think I've trained them unintentionally to stop touching the electrified muffin. And so often I'm like, oh, here's this great magic item I'll put here in the adventure and they'll have that and that'll be great. They'll need to do this one thing to get it, but that'll be great. And more often than not, they do not pick up the thing anymore. It is left behind for that reason. So I need to incentivize them stronger.
Ben, they've optimized all the fun out of your game.
Yeah. the other thing I'd just quickly say, if you're doing this folds into things, because moral complexity is a core tenet of Grim Hollow. And so, you know, I've created a whole channel about how to structure these sort of campaigns. But if you have a campaign that is based on moral complexity and making difficult choices, also just sprinkle in some easy choices too. Just a little bit of sprinkling, sprinkle in some wolves, sprinkle in some zombies, sprinkle in a golem, you know, something that the players can just murder and not feel bad about it so that they can use their character abilities, or a clearly unambiguous evil thing happen, or whatever it happens to be, just so they don't burn out on the like, oh, this choice also sucks. You know what I mean? There is a deftness to...
You need a faction that you can just kill indiscriminately.
Yes.
Just and hack and slash.
Honestly, something that I keep in mind from you, Dale, very frequently when I'm designing narratives around this sort of thing is, you know, tempt your players. Tempt them to want to make a decision. Don't make it both roads seem dark. Make it seem like they have to go through a dark wood to get to a location, you know. Let them have some form of victory, even if that victory is incomplete.
Easy.
You know what it all comes down to? What's really helpful is empathy.
Let's do all the plugging. James Hague, if people want to send in an email like JP did to the Eldritch Lorecast, where would they send it to?
You picking on me, Ben? would send it to podcast@ghostfiregaming.com, or they would come to our Twitch chat at ghostfire_official. Twitch.tv/.
Sean Merwin, what times do we stream?
Surprisingly, we stream at different days because we're in different locations. On Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific time, you can catch us live. Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern time, that's where I am. And if you want to do that Australia thing, in Sydney and environs, and Melbourne and environs, you can catch the show at 10 a.m. on Tuesdays.
That is very true. Just a quick head of time warning for folks. As daylight savings starts in the U.S., I think in about 2 or 3 weeks, those times are going to change. So just giving folks a quick heads up about that, but we'll chat about that off air so that we can figure out exactly what that time's going to be. Dale Kingsmill, I don't have a question for you, so just tell us a cool fact.
Yay, a cool fact.
Yeah.
Iceland is in the North Atlantic. Its capital city is Reykjavik.
Perfect.
Very cool.
I've been Ben Byrne here with James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, and we will be back next week and every week thereafter until the end of time with another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. Yoke folk solidarity.
We have a pact.
We have a pact. We're not doing the butters anymore. We decided this during the painting stream. We will be here all day, Dante, if you don't take us off air.
We will hold our butters.
I am willing to do it. I mean,
I'm having a butter breakdown here.
Like, there's a butter buildup.
Yes.
Having a butter block. Yeah. It's a real problem when the butter to block sets in.
Chat's doing it for us.
Yes, yeah, thank you,
Chat. Saving us.
If you want to see the butters, come catch us live on Twitch. For the butter to butters, the butter to buzz.
That's Wait, did very that count? Close to a butter to bang.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Forcing that butter to.
Power to the people!
We are taking back control of the Lorecast.
Mm-hmm.
we'll just sit here, Dante. We're happy to do it. We're happy to get boring. We got places to be. Come on.